It may cause some wonder among the more inquiring of you, ladies and gentlemen, as to how one person can combine both the art of publishing and the art, so-called, of writing. This is not a common occurrence that a man can be a publisher and an author at the same time, because although closely related by business ties, publishers and authors do not get along any too well. In fact, the relationship has been likened often to that of an old married couple who need each other very much, but know each other's weaknesses so terribly well that they know exactly where to sink that harpoon where it will do the most damage. Practically every author that you meet will tell you what a rat his publisher is, an ungrateful creature out only to make money on his genius, doesn't understand his temperament, absolutely no interest in art, and so on and so on and so on. Meanwhile, the publisher is wailing over in his corner that every author is an ingrate, that he is only a kind, nice fellow until he has a success, at which point he goes flying off to Hollywood and forgets all about the publisher who sustained him while he was getting to the top. Having been in the publishing business for some 25 years, I know that there is a great deal of truth in both these assertions. So how do I get to do both of them? This was a great feat. This enables me to achieve something that every publisher has always dreamed of doing. Every morning, I hear these authors come in with their time-honored complaints. They're always the same. There's been no ad in the Chicago Tribune last Sunday. Why wasn't my book on sale at Brentano's? My cousin was at Marshall Field's yesterday and couldn't find a copy. My sister was down in New Orleans. There are no books down there. We listen to this all day long from disappointed authors, but I am the only publisher who, when he gets it up to here, can put on my hat and coat and go running over to my publisher and make exactly the same kind of a nuisance to myself. This dual personality reminds me a little bit of a story that's gone the rounds for a long time about two businessmen whose wives went off on a vacation together, leaving the two husbands at home to keep house as best they could while the wives were away. And they kept house in the usual way, letting the dishes pile up in the sink, brushing the dirt under the rugs, and leading a very bohemian and idyllic existence. One night, one of the two husbands brought home a 4-pound steak for dinner, and he put it down on the kitchen table. And the two wives being away, hundreds of miles away in the lake country, the two men decided to have a couple before dinner. And they had several. And at long length, wove their way uncertainly out of the kitchen, whereupon they discovered, lo and behold, that the 4-pound steak had vanished completely from sight. And one of the men said, "I know we've had several drinks, but I also know I put that steak down on the table and it couldn't walk off by itself." So they instituted an immediate search, and suddenly one of them thought he had located the culprit, because sitting under the sink was a big, sleek black cat licking his whiskers very contentedly. And he said, "I'll bet that cat has eaten our 4-pound steak." And the other one said, "Well, there's a very quick way of proving your assertion." He took the cat by the scruff of the neck and marched it into the bathroom where there was a scale. And he put the cat on the scale, and it weighed exactly 4 pounds. And he looked up in triumph, and he said, "Well, there's our 4-pound steak. Now where the hell is the cat?" This is the quandary I find myself in, wondering sometimes whether I'm a publisher or an author. And then to add to all the confusion, about 2 years ago, in a moment of madness, I went on a television show, which is a weekly performance, which only hits here as a fringe area, I know, but I'm sure some of you have seen What's My Line on Sunday nights in other parts of the country. Program we do every Sunday night for our considerable pleasure and a great deal more money than we can ever make out of publishing books. This confuses the issue still further. For those of you who haven't seen What's My Line, the gimmick is a panel of four people who try to guess the profession of various people who come up on the platform, and we must then guess, if we can, what they do. getting only yeses or noes as answers. And it's a very popular program, which puts us in the position of now being considered experts. If we get the answers, everybody says the program is fixed. If we don't get the answers, we're just stupid clunks who should be replaced. And it makes you quite famous around the country. But publishing and writing books, that gets you nowhere with the general public, as you know. But if you're a television personality, this means everybody knows you. You see people turning around, looking a little puzzled, saying, where have I seen that face before? And then the sudden light of recognition. Oh, that's that fellow on What's My Line. Doormen at hotels, waiters, dining room stewards, they all know you by your first name. This is a great pleasure. Everywhere you go, everybody says, hello, Pennant. Boy, were you terrible Sunday night. But it all adds to the complications. Now, where did all this start? There is a start for this. And mine start goes back to my college days at the Columbia School of Journalism. And whenever I come on a campus, of course, this will happen to you when you get out. For any time you hit a college campus, your thoughts go rushing back to your own undergraduate days, and the longer they are behind you, the more wonderful they seem in your memory. I went to the Columbia School of Journalism at a time when we had a very, I can't tell you what, a strange president we had at Columbia in the old days. His name was Nicholas Murray Butler, and he had been president of Columbia as long as the oldest citizen could remember. In my time, he was already in his 80s, and he went on for quite a while after I got out. He was a very unapproachable gentleman. There were only two ways that an undergraduate could ever get to meet Dr. Butler in person. One of them was to give $1 million to the university. The other one was to get to be the editor of The Jester, the funny magazine up there, and print a joke that Dr. Butler didn't like. I gave this matter careful consideration and chose the latter method. When I was a sophomore at Columbia, the editor of The Jester was a very clever young man named Maury Riskin. Maury Riskin edited Jester with a very high hand, wrote anything he pleased in it, and in the very first issue of my sophomore year, incurred the displeasure of Dr. Butler by an editorial in which he referred to Dr. Butler in not too complimentary terms. In fact, what he said was, Dr. Butler is an idiot. The next day, Mr. Riskin made a very hurried departure from Columbia University. And since he had been the third editor-in-chief to be kicked out in 2 years, the job was now considered hot. And nobody wanted it very much. There's an interesting and ironic footnote to this history I'm telling you. About 15 years later, Dr. Butler had to receive Maury Riskin back at Columbia and present him with the Pulitzer Prize for his play Of Thee I Sing. But this was still far in the future, a humiliation that Dr. Butler did not foresee. Well, they couldn't find any senior who would take the job. They couldn't find any junior who would take the job. So suddenly I, a lowly sophomore, found myself editor-in-chief of The Jester by default. I was practically the last person on the campus they had asked. Promptly got an enormous swelled head, looked around at the available material, and my first move was to make, as my art editor, a very wonderful young man named George Gillette. I can see his face as I talk to you now. George didn't draw very well, but his father was the president of the Gillette Safety Razor Company. I figured in my boyish, naive fashion that if we made Gillette art editor, we'd get a full-page ad every issue from the Gillette Safety Razor Company. Gillette drew a picture for our first issue, which gave me the opportunity of meeting Dr. Butler in person. There was a dance craze prevalent in those long-forgotten days called the shimmy. The shimmy was a dance in which you clutched your partner firmly to your bosom and didn't move either north, south, east, or west. You just stood in one spot and bounced up and down. And Gillette drew a picture of a couple doing the shimmy. And sitting at a ringside table, there was a very fat English lord watching the proceedings. And the caption underneath described somebody coming up to the English lord and saying, Lord Hemingway, what do you think of that couple doing the shimmy over there? And Lord Hemingway's answer was, All I can say is, I hope he marries the girl. The next morning, when I met Dr. Butler, I walked into his office. I can still see him sitting at this enormous desk. All that there was on the desk was a little card with my name on it. And he looked down and he said, Mr. Cerf, I have only two things to tell you. He said, one is that English lords do not customarily speak with a Cockney accent. And he said, the second thing I have to tell you is that one more joke or picture like that in jester, and you will follow Mr. Riskin out of this university so quickly that you won't know what happened to you. And with my usual presence of mind, I said, yes, sir. And this concludes my entire association with Nicholas Murray Butler. But anyhow, now I was launched on a career of humor, collecting it, something I've never quite got out of my system. When I got out of Columbia, I went to the publishing business and for some 20 years, built up Random House and the Modern Library, published such authors as William Faulkner, Eugene O'Neill, Sinclair Lewis, Vincent Sheehan, Quentin Reynolds, Irwin Shaw, Bud Schulberg. We have a rather good stable of authors. But all the time on the side, running through my head were all these countless stories that I'd heard. And during the war, I had a sudden outlet for all these things I'd stored up in my memory. You may remember in the first days of World War II, we, as usual, were not prepared. Democracies never are ready for wars. That's why they're democracies. They're not geared for wars unless they have to be. And we were caught short, and for the first 5 or 6 months of World War II, the news was uniformly terrible. We got licked at Bataan, and we got licked everywhere else. The English were licked with us. There was that black, awful day when the Repulse and the Prince of Wales were sunk off of Singapore. Do you remember all that? And the news was so grim that the country was sinking into a torpor, a stupor almost, of disappointment and frustration. And it occurred to me that possibly this was a good time to make people laugh again, if possible. Laughter is a medicine that cannot be overestimated. There is nothing like laughter to clear the atmosphere. There is nothing like laughter to take that tense feeling out of a person. If you can throw back your head and give vent to a good solid laugh, you can get a lot of terrible things out of your system all at one time. So with that thought in mind, I collected a lot of stories, called it the Pocketbook of War Humor. And it came out at 25 cents a copy, and because it was timed right, it sold about 2 million copies. So here I was launched as a professional humorist. I immediately went to the well again, as every writer does who hits the jackpot once, and got together another book, which was going to be called The Pocketbook of Anecdotes, and was going to sell for 25 cents a copy too. But by this time, there were shortages all over the country, and books were selling to beat the band because people couldn't do very much else. They had to read books. And my publisher, a very canny fellow, said, this book isn't too bad. Why do we bring it out at a quarter? Let's try it as a regular book. So there on the spot, the Pocketbook of Anecdotes, which was to be 25 cents a copy, became Try and Stop Me at $3 a copy. And I've always considered it one of the greatest gyps ever perpetrated on the American public. But again, it came at the right time. And had a fantastic sale. And now I was really known as the Joe Miller of the day, to my wife's disgust, but it was a heady sort of excitement. And that's how the double career started. And Lord knows where it's all going to end. Well, changing trends in American humor, wasn't it, Mr. Fuller? Well, let's get on to changing trends in American humor. Following this career, which has now become more than a hobby, it's half of my life, has proven interesting in more ways than one, because humor does change. We don't realize it from day to day, but if you make a study of it, you'd be amazed to see how the trends of things that make people laugh in this country shift from time to time. To be serious for a moment, go back to the beginning of this century. The three outstanding humorists in America at the turn of the century were names that most college people today never even heard. One of them was Artemus Ward. The second was Bill Nye. And the third was a very amazing gentleman named Peter Finley Dunne, who had a character named Mr. Dooley. Mr. Dooley was quoted as much at the turn of the century as Will Rogers was 20 years later, or as Jack Benny or Arthur Godfrey are today. These names are forgotten now. Their humor is rather thin if you try to resuscitate it. After they went on their way, the next great name in American humor is that of Mark Twain. Oddly enough, we don't consider Mark Twain really a humorist anymore. We consider Mark Twain possibly as great a novelist as ever lived in this country or any other. And Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn are the great stories of boyhood. They're not considered essentially humorous. That's a byproduct. But when he went on his way, humor languished in America. Josh Billings was about the top, until out of the Oklahoma plains, unheralded and unsung, sprang the greatest native wit in our history. And that, of course, was Will Rogers, who I would say is the top figure of all time in humor in this country. When he died on that ill-fated little hop up in Alaska, an ironic footnote, after traveling all around the world in a plane, he and Wiley Post, the leading aviator of the day, were killed in a little puddle jump, 15-minute jump up in Alaska. When he went, there was nobody here to take his place. And for some years, humor languished, until almost full-blown, they sprang into existence the humor of insult that has governed humor in this country until the last 2 years, I would say. The wisecrack school, the kind of joke that depended for its great laugh on being at somebody else's expense. There could be 14 people in a room, 13 of them would roll on the ground with laughter, while the 14th one suffered because he had been the butt of the joke. And this humor was developed to a fine art in America, because we are a very volatile people and we can let those wisecracks go very, very quickly. And there were great artists in the form of the wisecrack. In books, you read Dorothy Parker, or even Robert Benchley would descend to the wisecrack school quite often. In the theater, we had those master craftsmen, Kaufman and Hart, who wrote The Man Who Came to Dinner, probably the greatest play, comedy of insult that's ever been written, depending entirely on hitting at people for its big laughs. That time was about the time that the radio became popular. So what more natural that the radio writers seized upon this humor of insult? And once they had it in their grip, they've hung on tenaciously ever since. And they haven't changed since radio came into its own. If you analyze for a moment any one of the big comedy programs in radio, you'll see that it's the comedy of insult. Jack Benny, Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, any of them. Analyze the routine of their weekly programs, and you'll see that the central character is the butt of continual insults from the rest of the cast. The gimmick changes. In the case of Jack Benny, it's because he's stingy. In the case of Bob Hope, it's because he has a sharp nose or wears a bit of a toupee. In the case of Bing Crosby, it's because he has no hair at all or has racehorses that come in last. The gimmick changes, but as I say, the formula is unending, the same. Now, it's not because these fellows are not sharp comedians, and not because they don't want to change. They're not allowed to change by their sponsors. Fred Allen quit entirely because he got sick and tired of doing the same thing week after week, but the sponsors, who pay their bills, God bless them, won't let any comedian change his act once he's gotten to the top. He's got that top rating, which means that a certain number of millions of people are watching him, and the sponsor says, don't monkey with the buzzsaw. You go right on doing what you want until your rating drops by itself. So that's why they do the same act week after week after week with very, very minor variations. Well, about 2 years ago, this wisecrack school started to fade away in America, and we began to go back to the humor of character, the humor that might not make you laugh quite so hard, but that made a little impression on your heart. It left a little glow of pleasure after it was over, instead of just making you let out this spontaneous roar of laughter and then forget about it entirely. This coincided with what was going on in the world of books, because the mood is the same with the people, whether it be for their humor or for the books they read or the plays they go to see. It's the mood of the people that decides what is going to be holding the boards. And in America, the mood of the people is the most fluctuating, the most volatile in all history. I remember, and I'm sure you do too, the exaltation that swept this country when our troops in Korea were marching north with nothing in the way, and it looked as though the whole thing was going to be over in a few days, and General MacArthur even indicated that we'd all be home for Christmas. I was in Texas, of all places, when that happened, and all the Texan people were even more pleased with themselves than usual, which is par for the course. But then came the news, suddenly, that out of nowhere had come the Chinese communists pouring across the Yalu River, and you remember those disastrous few days when it looked as though everything was lost and we were retreating in broken disorder before this new onslaught. Well, overnight, the whole American public was turned into a race of complete pessimists. Even in Texas, they were talking about all being lost, the greatest disgrace in our history. Everybody sat around moping. And then 2 or 3 days more went by, and it became apparent that we'd hold them, after all, that it was a beating and a setback, but not a complete disaster, and that we wouldn't have to leave Korea, that we'd be able to stop somewhere south of the 38th parallel. And overnight, back went the spirits of the people, and the same man who had been telling me he was going to enlist the day before to get over there himself was now belly aching the next night because he couldn't get delivery on his new Cadillac convertible right away. That's the way the people go bouncing up and down. And they do it in the books they read, too. If I can bring this book story up to date to match where I was with humor for you for a minute, we can trace in publishing how the tastes of the public changed. There was the days during World War II when everybody was reading war books, either memoirs of returning heroes or correspondents or novels based upon the war. Then the war ended and you couldn't give away a book about the war. Every publisher, including myself, was stuck with contracts that we tried to get out of by hook or crook. The bookstores were stuck with thousands of books about the war that nobody would buy. Everybody now wanted to read a new kind of book. It seemed that all of a sudden, every drunkard in America was writing his memoirs. That was the era of the Lost Weekend and the story of Mrs. Murphy. And with it came books about people who had suffered some kind of nervous reaction to the war, who had cracked under the strain. I published the first of those in a book called The Snake Pit by Mary Jane Ward, which I'm sure a lot of you remember. The story of a girl who had been insane for 6 months and gone to a state institution and then recovered her sanity. Well, that book was a smash hit. And that was a book that, by the way, exemplifies the glamour and excitement of book publishing. That's why books like that are why anybody who gets into the publishing business is lost for life, never leaves it. Because anybody can publish a bestseller by Ernest Hemingway or John Marquand or Edna Ferber. That requires no skill. These are people who are established. You bring out the book and sit back and wait for the customers to buy. But the thrill of publishing is to take somebody that nobody's ever heard of before, a brand new book, as this was, by an unknown girl, and watch this book go into a bestseller, watch it be chosen by the Book of the Month Club, condensed in Reader's Digest, finally be made into an Academy Award motion picture out in Hollywood. All this happened to the Snake Pit. We thought the excitement would be so much that the girl might have a relapse, but it didn't. She took it in stride. The only one who was a little upset was her husband. When this book smashed through, everybody else who had had a nervous breakdown also came to Random House with their manuscripts. There was a period when our waiting room looked like the receiving ward of Bellevue Hospital. I never dared come in the front entrance. I remember one day, however, I came walking in dreaming of something else, and a little gray-haired lady grabbed me at the door, and before I could move, she poured her tail into my ears. She thrust into my hands a manuscript, and she said, "Mr. Search, you've got to read this right away, because I'm surrounded by enemies, and if I left it here, somebody would steal it immediately, or might even kill you," she said. "So you'll have to read this while I wait." Well, I realized I was in trouble, but there was nothing I could do about it, because I couldn't have shaken her off, try as I might. So I marched into my private office with her in tow, and she planted this manuscript down on the desk and took a position immediately behind me, breathing hotly down the back of my neck. And I opened the box and took out the manuscript and started turning the pages of the manuscript, and soon made a rather interesting discovery. There wasn't one word on one page of this paper. It was a sheaf of absolutely blank typewriter paper. After I'd turned about 20 pages with her right behind me, thinking furiously, I finally found a way out. And I turned around and I said, "This is the most remarkable manuscript that's come to Random House in many a day." And it was, too. But I said, "Don't you think we're the wrong publishers for this book? After all, we did do The Snake Pit. Wouldn't it be an anticlimax if we would do another book along the same lines?" And while she was mulling this, I got the paper back into the box under her arm and sent her rushing happily off to Doubleday and Company. Well, that era passed, finally, and then America went off on a new spree. Suddenly, everybody in America would read only historical romances. Novels that if they had been about you and me, the author and the publisher would have been carted off to jail immediately. But as long as you called your hero Louis the 14th and your heroine was a duchess, and you had a background in history that you had stolen discreetly from Daniel Defoe or one of the old masters, you could get away with it. And somebody has described these historical novels as books with beautiful girls on the jackets, but no jackets on the beautiful girls. Well, I guess the classic example of this school was that immortal novel, Forever Amber, which the author will have a lot to answer for on Judgment Day. But that spree ended in due course. There'll always be a good market for a real historical novel, but the mania passed. And then we went into a phase that still holds today, and that has moved over into the field of humor as well, and that's the nostalgic period. The period when suddenly we've all become very much aware of our roots. Suddenly, the lives of our grandfathers and our great uncles and aunts, people we had thought were bloody boars once, now seem quite glamorous to us in that respect, because we don't know where we're headed ourselves. We're living in a perpetual crisis, in a turmoil, and suddenly the lives of these simple folk are infinitely appealing. People whose houses never heard words like Russia and China and Germany once in 2 years. Nobody bothered about those other countries. When the Sunday pleasure consisted of harnessing up the horse and buggy and going for a ride over a muddy road for 6 or 7 miles. Now that seems kind of nice to us. We kind of like to be back there ourselves. And that explains why suddenly there was a rash of big hits on Broadway and novels and movies like Life with Father and I Remember Mama and Rain Tree County and Meet Me in St. Louis, all nostalgic stories of the America of 2 or 3 generations ago. Now, that's escape reading, if you will. This led to the fact that last year, for the first time in literary history, a phenomenon took place that amazed people in the publishing business, where all 4 best-selling books in America were on a single subject. They were all about the sea. In fiction, there was the Caine Mutiny and the Cruel Sea. In nonfiction, there was The Sea Around Us and Kon-Tiki. 4 leading bestsellers from one end of the country to the other, all about the sea. People obviously thought they could get release from their own tough times by imagining themselves out on the bounding main with the salt spray blowing into their faces. And now we've got the new Hemingway book, also about to see. So now there are 5 big-selling books because the other 4 continue to sell well. All about the sea. This is Escape, of course. And in this nostalgic mood, we're liking different kinds of stories, too. Now, the only way I can exemplify what I mean by this, I think, is by telling you what I call a typical story of today. It's not a funny story at all. It's an anecdote with a couple of amusing overtones, but it won't make you laugh. But if you're anything like me, it'll leave you with this pleasant little glow. It's a story that stems, oddly enough, from a single paragraph in Carl Sandburg's biography of Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln. And this single paragraph was sold last year to Hollywood while I was out there. It was bought by RKO. It was bought by the Hardest Boiled Studio in Hollywood, that studio that was owned by Howard Hughes and which is presently going through all kinds of revolutions. Haven't made any pictures there for months. All they're doing is fighting over who owns what. But they bought this picture last year, and 10 years ago, no studio would have touched it with a 10-foot pole. Here's the story. Some of you may have heard it because there was a one-page resume of it, I think, in Reader's Digest. It seems that when Abraham Lincoln was elected President of the United States in 1860, the next morning, his picture was printed on the front page of newspapers all over the country. Commonplace today, Lord knows. But in 1860, this was an absolute innovation because the daguerreotype machine, whereby photographs can be reproduced on newsprint, had just been perfected. And Lincoln was the first president whose picture appeared on the paper, on newspaper. And probably several million people saw his face the first time the day after he was elected. And among the people who saw this picture for the first time, there was a little 9-year-old girl named Grace Bedell, who lived in a tiny village in upstate New York called Westfield. And Grace Bedell looked at the picture of Lincoln and sat down and wrote him a letter. Some of you, being so near Springfield, probably have seen this letter because it's on display at the museum in Springfield. And she said, "Mr. Lincoln, I don't think you look the way a president should look, and if I were you, before I took office, I would grow a beard." Well, one of the secretaries at Mr. Lincoln got this note from this 9-year-old girl, and knowing that Mr. Lincoln had a sense of humor, those were days when candidates for president were allowed to have a sense of humor. They showed him the letter, and he was amused, and he sat down and he answered Grace Bedell. And he said, "Dear Grace, I deeply appreciate your interest, but don't you think it's rather late in the day for me to grow a beard? After all, I've been seen by an awful lot of people, and they've seen my face, and wouldn't it be silly if I grew a beard at this stage of my career?" And this little 9-year-old brat answered him and said, "No, it wouldn't be silly at all, because as a matter of fact," said, your face frightened me. And if it frightened me, it probably frightened several 100,000 other American boys and girls. And she said, "I don't think it's the business of a president of the United States to frighten children." This, too, was a long time ago. But he got this letter. And this might have been the end of the episode. As I say, I'm sure Professor Randall will bear me out that these letters, the paraphrases thereof, are on exhibition down at Springfield. This might have been the end of the story, except for the fact that some months later, Mr. Lincoln discovered that the train that was going to take him to the inauguration from Springfield to Washington would go through this little village of Westfield. And he sent word to the mayor that he would stop the train for a moment, and he hoped the whole town would turn out, and he particularly wanted to meet Grace Bedell. So the day came about, and the train did stop in accordance with his promise. Possibly this was the first whistle stop we ever had in America, but Mr. Lincoln put on his stovepipe hat and he walked out to the back platform, and the mayor had rounded up the townsfolk. The whole town was there, possibly 300 people. And Mr. Lincoln smiled at the crowd and said, "Is Grace Bedell in the crowd?" And this little 9-year-old girl, dressed in a white dimity dress with a little matchstick legs and white cotton stockings, came forward and looked up, and in a little shrill girlish voice said, "I'm Grace Bedell." And Mr. Lincoln leaned over the back platform and he said, "Well, Grace, you see,
I took your advice, and I grew whiskers. What do you think? And she looked up at him and said, oh, Mr. Lincoln, you look beautiful with those whiskers, and I'm sure you're going to be the greatest president this country ever had. And Mr. Lincoln smiled, put on his hat, walked back in, and off puffed the train. And probably only three or four people in that crowd were aware of the fact that they had just seen American democracy at work, clicking on all cylinders, when a little nine-year-old girl and the president-elect could have a conversation of this sort. Well, as I say, there's a story that RKO is now going to try to make into a full-length feature picture. I am not in a position to tell you exactly how they are going to bring it about. Probably by the time it's released, you'll find that the part of Grace Bedell is portrayed by Marilyn Monroe. But there's the kind of story I mean that is more popular today than the wisecrack. The power of these stories is immeasurable. The way people listen to them. James Gordon Bennett, the old editor of the New York Herald, once said that for every person who read a serious editorial in the newspaper, there were 500,000 people who told a joke in America. The story spread like wildfire. People often ask me, where do you get all these stories that you print? Well, they come from all over, and they're circulated, and once people know you like funny stories, they save them for you. Somebody has estimated there are only about 20 original stories in the whole country. But these stories have been atomized into millions of particles. The props have changed. The cast of characters has changed. The tagline is twisted just a little bit, and bang, you've got a new story. And somebody tells this new story at New York at 9 o'clock. You've got it here in Urbana and Champaign at 10. That night, four comedians out in Hollywood tell it on the radio, and 6 months later, Walter Winchell originates it. This is the way these stories go flying around the country. I did say that all our humor had shifted. I noticed this particularly when I got this last book of mine together. I just perpetrated a new one called Good for Laugh. And by the way, I defy you to find an unsigned copy at any bookstore in this area. I've been around today with Quincy Howe on a bicycle, signing every copy I could grab. I think by mistake I also signed a few new revised Bibles, too. But before I put this new book to bed, send it to press, I took the very wise precaution of comparing the copy with Try and Stop Me and the intervening books, because the worst thing a professional humorist can do is to repeat himself. You know how bad it is yourself if you start telling a friend a story and he fixes you with a beady eye and says, well, you told me that story yesterday. Very humiliating. For a professional, it's much more than humiliating. It's sometimes disastrous. So I always go through these books to make sure I haven't, not using jokes that I used in previous collections. I always catch a few, too. But this is when I was able to see how in the 8 years that have passed since Try and Stop Me came out, how this humor has changed in the way I describe. Now, I did notice that there were three or four categories that didn't change and that will remain the same, and I hope they do for a long time to come. Three categories of humor that I would like to catalog before I finish this speech. And the first of them, as a tribute to Mr. Fuller, of course, is that beautiful branch of humor called pun. Puns to me are sometimes get just as much abuse as we used to shower on Harry Truman. It's considered good form to sneer at puns. As a matter of fact, a clever pun is very hard to come by. And the only difference between a good pun and a good joke is that you're working for a different effect. You tell an ordinary joke, you're looking for laughs. You tell a pun, all you hope to get is a deep, dark, dismal groan. If your audience groans hard enough at a pun and shakes his head unhappily enough, you can rest assured he is merely waiting for you to get out of the room so that he can tell this pun as his own creation. I told Quincy one this morning that I'm going to ask him to bear with me while I repeat it, because I want to get it in before he uses it on his broadcast. It's a brand new one, and it concerns the Ree family. Sigmund Ree being very much in the news tonight, having done the speech that the people out in Korea expected from Eisenhower. Eisenhower, as you know, had probably read already, didn't make any public appearances while he was over there, probably for security reasons. And Sigmund Ree, who must be a very old hat indeed to those South Koreans by this time, didn't quite fill his shoes. But this story concerns a nephew, probably mythical nephew of Sigmund Ree's, who came over to America to seek his career in journalism and got a job with the Loose Publications. And as soon as he got the job, vanished completely. Nobody could find him. So they put their best private eye on the job, and they said, "You find this young Ree fellow, if it's the last thing you do." And for 2 days, he searched fruitlessly for him, but suddenly he saw Mr. Ree in a bar on 3rd Avenue, and very unhappily said, "Ah, sweet Mr. Ree of life, at last I found you." This is probably as bad a pun as you will ever hear in your life. It typifies what I mean when I say people like them. Every once in a while I run a column in the Surfboard called the Pun American Conference, and the mail immediately gets so heavy I have to put on an extra girl just to open the letters. The last one produced 2,300 letters from all over the country. One of the best that came along, and I'm only going to tell you this one more pun, was a story about a man up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, whose name was Kissinger. Some of you may have heard this, and he thought Kissinger was a peculiar name, and he changed it. He had it changed to Collins. And after about 2 months, he got tired of Collins, came back to court, and had it changed to Doyle. And 3 months later, he was back again and said, "I don't want to be Doyle after all. I think I'd like to be Brown." Well, by this time, all his friends were hopelessly confused, of course, and went all around Grand Rapids saying, "I wonder who's kissing her now." That's a terror. Well, there's another type of humor that never changes, and that I'm particularly addicted to, and that's the Shaggy Dog story. The story in which animals talk. The story which makes literal-minded people absolutely go crazy. Who ever heard of an animal talking? And there are lots of examples of that. The best one, I think, was brought back to New York by McKinley Cantor, the author of Bugle Ann. Remember the voice of Bugle Ann? Long remember. He was making a tour of the army camps, the reactivated airfields down in Texas, and he brought this one back from one of them. He met a captain, he swears, in the Air Force who was 62 years old. And he said, "How can a man be 62 years old and only a captain in the Air Force when generals are 27? And this fellow's sad story was as follows. He said that during World War II, when he was 54 years old, he was still such a great flyer that he got his wings. And he was sent for final basic training to an island in the Pacific, an idyllic place, 1,000 miles away from the enemy, and beautiful in every respect, except for one thing. The CO was one of those nasty parties that you come across in the Army once in a while, who insisted on conducting drills in the middle of the night. They'd just be sound asleep when the alarm would sound, and they'd all have to jump up, get into their clothes, run down to the field, climb into their planes, start their motors, and sit there until the all-clear sounded. And it spoiled every night's sleep. But one night, this captain had a happy inspiration. He saw a little chimpanzee hanging around on the outside of the PX, and suddenly was struck with this idea. He grabbed the chimpanzee and dressed it in an officer's uniform, and he trained this chimpanzee to answer the call for him. When the alarm would sound, he would stay peacefully in bed, and the chimp, dressed in an officer's uniform, would run into his plane, sit there, start the motor, and sit there with his cap pulled down over his head until the all-clear sounded. And it worked like a charm, and this captain was a very happy fellow until one night he awoke with a feeling, a resentment, that something had gone wrong, and suddenly realized that the all-clear had never sounded. And he said, "Oh, Lord, this must be it." So he jumped into his clothes and he went rushing down onto the field just in time to see all the planes taking off at 3-second intervals from the runway. The only other man standing on the field was the CO.
And just as he got there, in perfect alignment, went his plane with the chimpanzee at the stick. And off it went into the wild blue yonder. And when every plane had gone, the CO took one look at him, turned on his heel, and walked to his quarters. And this captain said, well, that's my story. Ever since then, I've been a captain. I don't suppose I'll ever get a raise. And he said, I wouldn't mind that so much, but he said, the part that really galls me is that damn chimpanzee is now a lieutenant colonel. The third and last style of American humor that never changes is stories about brilliant children. I've got two little boys myself, one of 11 and one of 6. I'm still waiting for one of them to say one line I can print. It's always my neighbor's children, or Quincy Howe's children, or Harry Fulich, or somebody else's children that are making the brilliant remarks that are sent in to me. And the fact that very often these brilliant remarks are strangely similar to jokes that were printed in an almanac in 1877 never bothers the parents at all. They go on telling them as their own offspring's brilliant outpourings. But out of this category come some of the best stories we have. They come up from nowhere. And it's the true ones that really are funny. There was one in New York last year that I think might amuse you. One of the editors of the New York Times, typical modern father, bringing his child up in the progressive manner, a little girl, went to a progressive school, and at the age of 11, though her father was a distinguished editor on the Times, this little girl evidently had only one interest in life, and that was clothes. She had a passion for clothes. She read Harper's Bazaar and Vogue from cover to cover. She read the fashion page of every newspaper and didn't give a darn about anything else. And the father was a little bit worried about what was going to happen to this girl. But one evening, it seemed a turn had come in affairs, because she came home and announced very casually at dinner that they had had a lecture that day at school on a new subject, sex. And the father brightened and said, ah, at last a new interest in our little girl's life. And he turned to her and he said, well, did you enjoy the talk? And she said, it was all right. And he said, did you understand everything? And she said, yes, I guess I did. He said, well, haven't you got any questions you want to ask Mama and Papa? And she thought for a minute. She said, yes, I have one question, Daddy. What does a girl wear for a thing like that? This is a true story, and you can't make up stories like that. Well, I could go on with kid stories by the million for you, but I'm sure you don't want to hear a lot of specimen stories. I would like to tell you one story to wind up about the difficulty of affecting these changes. In business, it's not so easy to make changes to keep in tune with what you think the public wants. You know from your own habits how hard it is to change some little personal habit. Maybe the way you comb your hair or the way you eat your eggs in the morning. We get rooted in these habits, and to change them is very difficult. But everybody in America manages to do it, with the exception, of course, of people from Boston. They never change. But the rest of the country does. And in publishing, we have to change too. We're in a tough business in the publishing business, as I explained to some of the people over in the School of Journalism today. We can't pass on increased costs to the public the way automobile makers and steel makers can, because the public won't pay this increased price. They kick like steers when you add 25 cents to the price of a book, although they'll cheerfully pay $1 and $2 more for a theater ticket or a Scotch highball. But on a book, they holler if you try to pass on any of these increased costs. And the costs have been mounting in fantastic proportions to what they used to be. Newsprint, printing, everything that goes into the making of a book or a magazine have shot skyward. The result is that the margin of profit has gotten very small for publishers of books, magazines, and newspapers. The magazine world has taken it on the chin, I guess, hardest of all. And this despite the fact that their circulations and advertising revenue are at new highs. Life and the Saturday Evening Post, for instance, sell about 5 million copies a week. Reader's Digest is over 10 million now. These are figures nobody ever dreamed we'd hit with a single publication. As far as advertising revenue is concerned, well, a single page in Life today cost $20,000. One single page of advertising. The back cover of This Week magazine, which I am interested in because I appear in it, the back cover in color of This Week, one single page, cost $32,000. Well, now, how are they ever going to increase those prices? Only the biggest companies can afford that kind of money. And yet, despite all this fantastic advertising revenue and all this money that's pouring in from circulation, the magazines are making so small a profit that if there was a 10% drop, they'd be in the red. If you follow the stock market, you'll see that the stocks of companies like Curtis Publishing and Loose Time Life have not shared in the general prosperity of the country at all. They've actually gone down while all of the stocks have been going up for the past 3 or 4 years. And the people at Time Life are not the sort who take this sort of thing lying down. They're a very live, clever outfit. And Mr. Loose last year called in an efficiency expert. And he said, isn't there some way we can cut this spiraling overhead? It's driving us crazy. And this staff went to work and they began going through the Time Life organization from one end to the other. And they finally came across one department that showed promise. There was one department that was staffed by about 350 girls. And the only job that these girls had was to send out letters to people whose subscriptions were about to expire. These letters are the lifeblood of the magazine business. You have to get over 70% renewals of your old subscribers or you're out of luck, because it costs too much to get new subscribers every year. And if you can't get back 70% of the old suckers again, you're a dead duck. So that explains why every time about 8 weeks before any subscription of yours to a magazine expires, you begin to get a series of heartbreaking letters from the editors. Are you going to face your children without Red Book on the table? What would life be without the Saturday Evening Post? You know the kind of letters I mean. After about four of these appeals, you begin to get special offers. Because you live in Urbana, you are now a member of the Gold Medal Club. So you get a dollar off if you send in the coupon right away. Every gimmick that's ever been thought of by clever advertising men has been used in this effort to pull back the old subscribers. Even after you've sent in your renewal, you get these letters because it's automatic. Well, at Time Life, these 350 girls were just sending out these letters. And the efficiency staff told Mr. Luce, if you could get a machine to do this, you would save between $750,000 and $1 million a year. So Mr. Luce went straight to Tom Watson, the head of International Business Machine Company, and Mr. Watson has never resisted a challenge yet, nor failed in one. This fantastic company could make a machine, I'm sure, that if pressed, could produce babies. And they did, God forbid, he did get a machine that would do this job. It was about as big as this auditorium. It took about 400 people to install it, but it did the whole thing automatically. It put the name of every subscriber at Time and Life on a little tin plate, and with a series of dots and dashes at the top, it enabled the staff to send these names through the machine, and whenever it came to a name that was within 8 weeks of expiration, the plate dropped through a slot, and the name and address were printed on one of these heartbreaking letters. And the letter was then folded up, put into an envelope. The envelope was addressed, meter mail, went to a bag, down the chute to the basement where there were freight cars waiting, out to the world, and not one human hand touched the whole operation. And everybody was supremely happy, except possibly the 350 girls who were fired. Well, as I said before, however, you don't make changes like this without some day of reckoning coming into the picture. And Time Life had their day of reckoning one day last August. We had in New York about 5 or 6 days every summer when the humidity breaks through the top and life becomes practically unbearable and everything in New York sticks to everything else. You get up from a chair, the chair gets up with you. You shake hands with a friend, it takes a third party to pry you apart. Never occurred to anybody in the brilliant Time Life organization that possibly this machine had suffered from the humidity and also had gotten stuck. It was pounding away on one plate without anybody realizing it. And the first they knew that something had gone amiss, was when a lonely sheep herder out in Montana suddenly got 11,834 likes. Telling him the subscription of life was about to expire. This little town in Montana had never received this much mail in one day in its life. But always ready for an emergency, they hired a special truck. And they put these letters in several burlap bags. And they dumped them on the veranda of this sheep herder. And that night he came wending his way slowly over the lee. Probably with a copy of the Kinsey Report under his arm. And he came onto the veranda. And saw his mail. And was mildly surprised, since he hadn't received as much as a postal card for the previous 6 months. But gamely, he took a knife and opened one of the bags, and he began to read his mail. And after he had read about 34 of these letters, he got the general idea. So he went into his, he went inside to his ranch house, and he opened his desk, and he made out a check for $6, made out to the personal order of Harry Luce. And he sent it to Mr. Luce direct with a note saying, "I give up." Well, this seems like a pretty good place for me to give up. I thoroughly enjoyed my introduction, which was very witty and lovely. And I particularly liked the audience I had. You've been very quiet and sympathetic. And I hope you'll ask me back someday again. Thanks a lot.